So what happens when an interviewee becomes the interviewer? Moments you must watch today.
And what she said about you and Boebert having an intimate relationship.
When did you all become a tabloid? Seriously, dude.
Since last year, a decision was to remove all the military production from Ukraine to Europe.
I see no evidence that the Ukrainians are reversing the situation on the ground.
True cost of military spending of the Pentagon between $1.5 trillion and $2.3 trillion.
You will only hear that right here. That's exclusive. Defense, $2.3 trillion? Seriously? By the way, Che Bose is going to be joining us here to talk about Finland. And then Brandon Weikart's going to be joining us. He advised members of Congress. He's going to explain to us the truth behind what's really going on with the war in Iran and the supposed deal. All this on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And I want to thank you for being there as you join millions of people who are tuning into our content on a regular basis. I can't tell you how much that means to us and how much we appreciate it. You know, there's a lot of war these days and a lot of talk of war these days, especially in the West, where wars are fought, it seems, mostly for money. Let's face it. Let's just tell the truth. But there's one politician in the United States in particular who's very much against these wars. His name is Thomas Massie. Now, I'm going to show him to you. There he is. I've told you about this guy. There he is. He's a congressman from Ohio. He's one of the very few politicians in the United States of America, my country, who refuses to be bought off. The rest pretty much do. This guy's relentless. And a lot of Americans are now looking to Thomas Massie as possibly the next president of the United States. That's the Fox News jingo, right? Cable news station. They're part of the pre-war neocon forces in the country of America, and they hate Thomas Massie. And it's not just them. It's other cable news stations like Fox News, where they appear to have come up with a plan. I'm going to show you something that is amazing. Watch here as Fox News sends a reporter to try and smear Thomas Massie while he's walking down the street. A reporter shows up with a microphone and starts asking Massie about some girlfriend he may have had in the past and some woman that he may have had sex with in the past. I mean, this is crazy. Here it is.
You could clear up the stuff your ex is saying about you with the NDA, that you pressured her to sign an NDA for wrongful termination. What is that true, what she's saying about you?
Who are you with?
With Fox Digital.
It's all false.
And what she said about you and Boebert having an intimate relationship?
It's all false.
Why do you think she's out there saying it? Was it because of the primary, ahead of the primary? What do you think is motivating it?
Can you believe this? Is it some woman, maybe she said something about you, so we just want to, you know... Usually, by the way, in the United States, when a politician has to answer questions about a, quote, girlfriend from the past or some relationship he's rumored to have had, that's not just bad journalism. That's not just tabloid. What you just watched there, that's a hit job. That's a hit job. That's an attack. And sometimes it works. Some politicians are brought down by this kind of stuff when it blows up. That's how they take people down. But Massie is a different type of politician. You want to see how he responds? He takes out his phone, like I just did right here, and he starts interviewing his interviewer. You've got to see this. Watch. Priceless.
When did you all become a tabloid? Seriously, dude.
But anything you could say.
So let me ask you. I heard that you like gay porn. Is that true?
I just want to give you a chance, your side of it.
That's
I'm not going
to
get into
are
that.
Are you a real news organization?
I'm not going to get into that.
No, come back, man.
No,
what
no.
You don't like
Congressman.
That you haven't been
to
those websites.
Of course I don't. Right. Of course I don't like it.
Really?
But thank you.
That's not what I heard.
Thank you for your time. Just giving you a chance to respond. That's all.
he did to the guy exactly what the guy was doing to him. Hey, somebody told me you like gay porn, right? We have no reason to believe it's true. We have no reason to believe, and I checked, that there was anything having to do with any girlfriend that had to do with Massey. He did to the reporter what the reporter did to him. You know what? Good for him. I mean, and you hear the guy at the end, well, I'm just trying to give you a chance to respond. Oh, yeah, right. That's all he's doing. Sure. See, these are the lengths in America that the pro-war factions working in concert with the mainstream media will do to try and destroy people who threaten their wars. They've done it to me. Threaten their relationships with Israeli donors, who threaten their relationship with big tech donors, you name it. They're not the only ones. But Massey saw it coming, and he turned the tables on the reporter. Now, just how powerful are these people who feel the need to try and smear or destroy people like Thomas Massey? And they're able to do it half the time. The answer to that question is this simple instruction that I give to you. Follow the money. And when we do that, we find out that the money is so big that it's actually worse than we thought. Let me show you something. So, according to recent reports, the U.S. defense budget was recently bloated to nearly $1 trillion. And everybody freaked out, hair on fire. Oh, my God, $1 trillion. That's crazy. Look at these headlines, right? They talk about this being a historic moment. Certainly way more than any other country on the planet. You take all of China's defense budget, all of Russia's defense budget, combine it with India's defense budget, throw in a couple more countries, and you're still not even close to $1 trillion. But last night after this show, I went up to my office and I had a conversation in my live stream with a really smart researcher who told me that's not true. He told me exactly how high the defense budget really is. So this guy's name is Dr. David Vine. He actually wrote the book, which I've read, The United States of War. It's a global history of America's endless conflicts. He's a very respected professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. What he shared with me from his latest findings that he did with a team of researchers is staggering. Listen.
What we found is that the true cost of military spending of the Pentagon of war as of fiscal year 2025, that is two fiscal years ago, was somewhere between $1.5 trillion and $2.3 trillion.
Did you hear that? The actual money spent on defense by the United States of America is between 1.5, not one, 1.5, and possibly up to $2.3 trillion, and he said afterward, told me, it's headed toward three million, right? Why do they then report it as a trillion? Because as he explained it to me, Congress hides many of the military items in the budget to make it look like they're non-defense budgetary items, when in fact they are defense budgetary items. By the way, who else is in on this, and why are they doing this? Listen to him.
The beneficiaries of this permanent war system have largely been the weapons manufacturers, the people within the military-industrial complex, powerful corporations like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and others who have benefited mightily from what President Eisenhower referred to as a theft, that every dollar spent is a theft from your grandchildren, from people in our communities. There are people benefiting and who want to see a perpetuation of endless wars. And this is precisely what we have to stop.
If you collect $2.3 trillion, of course you're going to find a way to spend it. Of course you're going to look for another war somewhere that you could start. You got to, or else you won't get another $2.3 trillion the following year, right? So can it be stopped? Especially when we're talking about these kind of astronomical numbers into the trillions and trillions of dollars? And does it make the next big war then inevitable? And should we be looking at Russia? Is a war with Russia in the plans? Poke the bear. You've heard that expression, right? It's a popular idiom in America. I looked it up. I'm nerdy that way. It means to deliberately provoke, irritate, or agitate someone. And the concept of the bear represents power, massive consequences when it is disturbed. Well, the bear in this case is Russia. And as you have seen in our reporting here of late, because we've been covering this story now for the last week and a half, there has been a lot of poking lately at Russia. Russian citizens are being targeted with missiles and drones and what appears as a sort of tactical terrorism. That's my word. On the part of the West, they're targeting Russian railroads. They're targeting buses and apartment buildings and energy facilities. Even children are being targeted. Just today, a six-month-old was killed by a drone in Russia. A baby. A baby. Yeah, we started reporting on this about a week ago or more, and millions of you have reacted. But since then, others have picked up on this story. A lot, many others. I've been seeing the stories everywhere. Tucker Carlson, here he is with a Russian military weapons expert who he invited as his guest last night. The guy's name is Viktor Bout, and he explains why the war in Ukraine is no longer about a war with Ukraine. It's now a war, he explains, clearly being waged by Europe against Russia. And here, with what you're about to hear, he explains when it changed and how. Listen.
Since last year, a decision was to remove all the military production from Ukraine to the Europe, which was done efficiently. More than a month ago, Russian Ministry of Defense published a list of all these factories who, in fact, in Europe, producing armaments for the Ukrainian army. So think of this. They are the logistics, their industries are now in Europe.
So they used to fight the war from within Ukraine, and now they're fighting the war from outside of Ukraine because the Russians were destroying too many of those facilities in Ukraine. What does that mean? Think about what that means. What he just described is a shift in the West's war strategy where the war is really being waged from Europe against Russia. Ukraine's just like a little proxy there, right? That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm seeing. That's what most people are seeing. So Professor John Mearsheimer is also talking about this. He was on with Danny Davis last night. He says it's happening. He says he sees it. And he says that despite what the Western media says, Russia is still winning the war on the front lines, per se. Here.
With regard to what's happening on the battlefield, the Russians are actually winning. Everything I read tells me that they're on the move, and they're well on their way to taking control of all of the Donbass. And this should be accomplished by the end of the summer, if not the early fall. I see no evidence that the Ukrainians are reversing the situation on the ground.
Okay, so some would argue then, big deal. So, yeah, the Russians are winning on the front lines. That seems pretty clear. He's saying that. A lot of other people are saying that. But what are the Russians going to do about it, their own people that are being bombed, right? We're seeing this. We're seeing the reports. I just told you about a six-month-old that was killed today by a drone. Here's Mearsheimer on that question.
The question that is then raised is, what does Putin do? And I believe that there is lots of evidence that the Russians are preparing themselves to strike military targets in Europe with conventional weapons. And if that doesn't work, they will use nuclear weapons. Now, Putin, of course, has not said this, but Sergei Karaganov has famously made this argument in the West. And if you read the Russian media carefully, there are all sorts of people inside of Russia who agree with Karaganov that it's time for the Russians to take off the gloves.
Time for the Russians to take off the gloves. Hearing that from a lot of people these days. By the way, to be fair, you're not hearing that from Vladimir Putin. You're not hearing that from Mr. Lavrov. You're not hearing that from any of the top leaders in Russia. But you're hearing it, like, from the periphery, right, from other people. And what we just heard in the explanation from some of these guys who are a lot smarter than we are in many ways, certainly John Mearsheimer, It means that, look, all of these supplies and all of these weapons and all of the steering and all of the training and all of the guidance and, more specifically, even the actual missiles and the drones that are targeting Russians, Russian civilians, they're in effect not coming from Ukraine. They're coming from Europe. And I presume, to some extent as well, from my country, from the United States of America. And that's a really big deal, right? That somehow is going to have to be dealt with in some way. All right. We're talking a lot about Europe. So joining us now for his weekly Eye on Europe, that's the segment we do with Che Boz, is Che Boz with reporting on a country who, by the way, most people don't think of this country as aggressors, usually. I mean, if you're anywhere in the world, if you're sitting in New York or Kansas or Georgia or my wife and kids in Miami right now, and somebody says Finland, do they think aggressors? Do they think a country that's looking for war? No, of course not. But Che is here to tell us that may not be the case. What do you got?
Well, Rick, it feeds very interestingly right into what you've been talking about, these voices on the periphery. Now, you might remember, I want you to have a look at a headline from a while back, mm-hmm. where the Finnish leader, Alexander Stubb, he sort of decided that, he was worried that the Americans were going to pull out of NATO. And on the basis of that, he tried to convince Donald Trump of this. Check out this headline, that the U.S. needed NATO to protect the United States from, from Russian nuclear weapons somehow. Have a look at it. The guys will throw up the graphic now. People kind of looked at this graphic and thought, or this headline and thought, this is a bit strange. This is a bit bizarre. Why would the Americans need the Finns or anybody else in Europe to defend the United States from intercontinental ballistic missiles, right? The U.S. and the Americans have each other zeroed in. You know that. We know this. Anybody who lived through the Cold War knows.
Yeah.
If one fires, the others fire, it's game over probably for everybody. But the Finns were very aggressively touting this idea. You need us to protect you from the Russians, right? Fast forward probably 4 months, and suddenly the Finns are saying, now, this feeds very much into what you're saying, you're talking about, this idea that the Russians are getting surrounded ever more with these threats. Yeah. The Finns have actually announced, and check out this headline, they've announced that they're going to allow, for the first time, nuclear weapons to be stationed in their country, okay? And this is a big, big deal. Why is it such a big deal? Well, firstly, because Finland shares a very, very long border with Russia.
Yeah.
Okay. And this means that potentially the British or the US could station nuclear weapons. And we all know what direction they'd be pointed in Finland, right? Yeah. Okay.
Really? You have no idea which direction they might be pointed in? I bet you if I gave you three guesses, you'd get the first one right.
Russia. Correct. Yeah, so if you see the initial statement, though, you need us to protect you, turned into, hey, why don't you park that nuclear missile in our backyard? We're happy to take it. Because the leader of Finland, this guy Alexander Stubb, has become an exquisitely Russophobic cheerleader for the war in Ukraine, for ramping up this Finnish militarism against Russia. Now, what's interesting about this is, and what the viewers may or may not know, is that Finland and Russia have a bit of history, okay?
Yeah.
And they fought a long and bloody war, the Winter War. And in the Second World War, the Finns, as you're saying, people associate them with, some nice vodka, the sauna, the beautiful forests. Well, in the Second World War, the Finns actually fought alongside the Nazis against the Soviet Union, okay? Now, in the aftermath of that war, you can check out this guy. This is Baron Mannerheim, the Finnish leader, and Adolf Hitler on his birthday meeting in Finland during the Second World War. They fought alongside each other. Very inconveniently now, historically, people in the EU don't want to talk about this. They also don't want to talk about the fact that in a place called Karelia, which was part of the disputed territory, and we can have a look at the map of that area, between the then Soviet Union and Russia and Finland. In Karelia, I want you to take a look at the next photograph. Mm. Here's a photograph of the region. You can see this was the disputed area between Finland and Russia. Mm. And at the time, by the way, the Russians offered very much like Ukraine, a deal to end the war on the basis of, you know, concessions and territory. The Finns ended up losing a lot more territory after they fought the war with the Soviet Union. But check out this next photograph of what happened in this place, Karelia. Have a look at the writing in this photograph of these kids. This is a concentration camp. Wow. Now, when we see images of this, like this, we can see, we think, you know, this has got to be the Germans, it's got to be the Nazis. This is a Finnish-run concentration camp in Karelia, in Russia, where they occupied this territory and they imprisoned children and Russian civilians, ethnic Russians, in concentration camps in this area. Now, this stuff is very hard to find if you look on the internet into the history of this, because in the aftermath of the Second World War and in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, the Finns and the Russians got on very well. They did a lot of business together. The business on the Finnish side of the border has been completely wiped out now as the Finns ramp up this pressure for some unknown reason on Russia. And you don't get a higher level of ramping up the pressure, Rick. As you know, you're a Cuban, right? You know about the Cuban missile crisis. The Finns are now saying, we're open for business, including putting missiles on our territory. And they're only facing one way, Rick. Amazing stuff.
Well, wouldn't you think that if they're serious about that, or if the Russians perceive that they're serious about that, the Russians will do two things. First, they will say, you put them there, we will blow them away. And then, if they put them there, they literally will blow them away. They will have to. There's no way in hell that Russia will allow itself, no more than the United States under John F. Kennedy in 1963, October, would have allowed the Soviet Union to put nuclear missiles pointed at Miami or Key West from Cuba, right?
Yeah. And it seems this reality seems very much lost in the Western media as they sort of try to ramp up this pressure on Russia from every angle. It's really remarkable stuff.
Do they not know that Russia has more nuclear warheads than any country in the world, including the United States? Do they not know that? I mean, you could literally, you know, you can take your little laptop here, my little MacBook or whatever the hell it's called, and you can Google it and you'll find out right away. It's not that hard.
And they have the most modern, accurate and unstoppable methods to deliver them. Look at Oreshnik. Again, it isn't convenient to the narrative. Russia has to be the bad guy. They got to ramp up. But putting nuclear weapons along the border with Russia, this is the kind of stuff that nearly sparked World War III in Cuba, with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Hmm. And it's amazing that this story from Europe isn't higher up on the agenda of the news pick, isn't it?
But I'll give you another one that happened today, which I'm sure you saw because you're much smarter than I am. Or at least you tell me that all the time when we go have beers.
That's true.
Starmer today, right? Keir Starmer today decided on his way out, because he's bucking for the job of NATO chief, that he is going to make the citizens of the UK pay another $15 billion for wars while their economy, the people of the UK, are suffering, and they get absolutely nothing back from those $15 billion, nor did they get anything back from the money spent in Syria or Libya or Iraq or Ukraine. In fact, it's actually negatively influencing their lives, and you could probably take us through that because we see it every day. But here's Keir Starmer again with what? I'm threatening to defend our country from Russia because they're on the brink of attacking us. That's bullcrap.
Yeah. And meanwhile, one of the only sectors in the British industrial society that is actually growing is food banks. Poverty's on the up, child poverty. The immigration crisis is a huge issue in the United Kingdom, absolutely massive. They're saying they're going to stop the Russian Navy. Again, they can't seem to stop these guys in flip-flops, in small boats arriving. It seems to be a huge movement of distraction against the realities of what's actually happening on the ground in Europe and in the UK in particular. And, of course, you fail upwards, it seems, in the United Kingdom. So Starmer, a brutally unpopular prime minister, has basically been thrown out of power. And where's he going to go? He's going to fall upwards like Mr. Rutte did. It's either into the UN, it's into, NATO. So there's no bar, it seems, for your achievements and your failure.
So why does he, and pardon me for interrupting you, but I'm excited about this idea that I wanted to share with you. Why does he come out today and say I'm sending, I'm collecting another $15 billion from my citizens of the UK, my taxpayers. I'm going to collect another $15 billion for them for defense. Why does he do that? Because he's trying to impress, my take, you tell me if I'm full of crap, he's trying to impress the bankers and the war profiteers and the weapons makers who will, if he does that kind of thing, that kind of gestures, they say, okay, this guy's all in on wars. Let's make him the next chief of NATO, right?
Absolutely.
He's applying for a job.
I don't think you don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to deduce that. It's obvious that he's playing to the gallery now, and he's sort of laying out the reality of what he's going to do. Now, remember, on the day that he resigned, essentially, the UK, there was five or at least between five and eight Storm Shadow cruise missiles fired at a factory in Voronezh, which killed five Russian civilians as well. Mm. It's all very cynical. And very rapidly, you can see the shift in these careerist politicians. As soon as they know they're done domestically, they have to start to show fealty to a new master. And that master is the military-industrial complex. As your earlier guest very clearly outlined, the reality of the money that's getting pumped into this machine is remarkable. Remember Mark Rutte, the current NATO boss? He was also a grossly failed politician. He was the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. He fell upwards as well. Look at Annalena Baerbock, the catastrophically foolish German foreign minister at one stage. She became a senior person in the United Nations. It seems absolutely remarkable to ordinary people how this failure seems to anoint you into these roles, all unelected roles. And finally, the biggest one of the lot, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Union, okay? Never elected by anybody in Europe. No European citizen ever cast a vote for Ursula von der Leyen. Germany didn't even support her for the role of president of the EU. She's still the president of the EU, Rick.
But did you hear my conversation with this guy, David Vine, I met last night and I interviewed him?
I found him to be
absolutely brilliant. He said, you know, in America, they say that the U.S. budget, defense budget, is $1 trillion. No, Rick, he said it's $2.3 trillion and heading toward $3 trillion. So I ask you, right? You know, for a hammer, everything is a nail. For somebody who has a budget in his pocket of $2.3 trillion and he has to spend it on military stuff because it's military defense budget, what's he going to do, right?
Yeah, sure.
He's going to look for a war. He's going to look for a new war to spend it on. We need another war, right?
Yeah, and I mean, look, if as you say, what many people might not realize is that when it comes to state budgets like this, if you don't spend what you got in year one, you don't get the same in year two. So you got to keep ramping up the pressure. And much of what we're hearing about, you know, Russia being a threat. Remember, they've been telling us, Rick, since the 1950s that the Russians were going to invade, but they never turned up. They never turned up when it was the Soviet Union, 15 republics, a much bigger military. The Russians never threatened Europe. They never stepped over this line. And, of course, we got to remember, when the Warsaw Pact, it was disbanded in 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, NATO, which was established to counter the Soviet Union, stayed. So it became a business, Rick. It's a business selling, you know, fire alarms and then going out and setting fires during the night in the town.
I'm looking at an article here and I'm seeing this all over the place. Let me see if I can pull this up. I don't know if you can see it or not, but you know, you can't see it right. I'll read it to you. New York Times front page today. Putin faces increased pressure as Moscow is again attacked by drones. They're reveling in it. They're salivating all over themselves. That's a Cuban expression, but it means, you know, that they're so happy to be able to feel so good about themselves to be able to write that headline. It's always about, ooh, now Putin's really in trouble. Ooh, the people of Russia are going to turn on Putin. Ooh, the pressure on Putin is mounting. These are the kinds of stories we see from these people, and this is really nothing new, but we're seeing a lot more of it now. What do you think? I mean, you know, you're a student of this. I mean, I played Mearsheimer's take, Tucker's take. I talked to Ritter about this recently, Karganov. I mean, all of these people have different opinions. Some are saying it's just a matter of time before Russia hits back, and they're going to have to. How often can you poke the bear before the bear growls, right? What are you hearing? What is your take, both as a person and as a journalist, on this?
Look, as somebody who's lived and worked in Russia for a long time, for years now, for the whole period of this this period of the war since 2022, at least, I've been living in Russia. The reality is, every time the Russians make a big advance on the battlefield, whether it's Pokrovsk, whether it's Bakhmut, and now, of course, it's Konstantinovka. We can't ignore the reality that every time the Russians make big advances and are about to swallow up another city, as they've been doing since 2022, we get this tidal wave of propaganda in the West. We get this tidal wave of
Wait a minute. Let me stop you, and I'm going to disagree with you. There was a real 6-month-old baby who was killed today by a drone. That's not fake. That's not the New York Times. By the way, they're not going to report that because it makes the Europeans look bad. There really is an onslaught of attacks against Russian civilians that is taking place in this country right now. I mean.
Sure.
You got to pay the piper, right? At some point, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's an official view and there's an unofficial view. As you said, you mentioned Kaganov, you mentioned Scott Ritter, you mentioned all the different commentators. They all have different views about what the reaction of the Russian state should be. The Russian state, since day one, since Vladimir Putin sat at his desk on the night of February 24, 2022, he very clearly stated, "This is what our objectives are. This is why we're here. Yeah. We believe it's legal. We've been asked by these republics to come and assist them." That will mean, as far as I'm concerned, until something very significant changes in the Kremlin, where Vladimir Putin says, look, this is no longer a military operation. This is a war. There's lots of things that would have to happen before major changes in how Russia is engaging with this conflict changed in themselves. Because, as I've said all along, if you want to know what the Russian plan is, you just have to listen to the Russians. The Russians say, we're going to achieve our aims on the ground in the special military operation.
Yeah, no, I know.
If the Europeans want to behave like terrorists, if they want to kill children, I mean, Rick, you and I were in Starobelsk together. We walked through that rubble together, you and I. We traveled there. We flew there together. We sat on the coach. We drove through those communities. We saw it together, right? You see that the determination of those people on the ground. You spoke to those old women at the site. You asked them, are you Ukrainians? Are you Russians? It was incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So from afar, the New York Times can say what it likes about Vladimir Putin being unpopular or that he's under pressure or whatever. You and I know that on the ground, in reality, he's still got a lot of support in Russia, huge support compared to other political leaders that I saw you outline on the board the other day.
Mm-hmm.
So, in reality, the Russians aren't going to play a role that's written for them in Whitehall in London or in the Pentagon, and definitely not in Brussels. Mm. That's my view. Of course, people get angry. They want to see responses. They want to see, a reaction to this stuff because they want to see the Kremlin act like the Pentagon, bombing a Houthi.
And it's a legitimate question and a legitimate conversation that you and I are having, and it's perfectly fine to have it. And people all over Russia are having it. So, it's fair. It's called democracy. It's like some people have this opinion, some people have that opinion. And those are the kitchen conversations that are taking place in Russia, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in Kazan, and all over this country right now. And we should be able to bring it to the forefront like you and I are having this conversation right now. By the way, thank you for mentioning that you're watching my show from time to time. Wow, I'm doing pretty good if Jay Bowes is checking in.
I let it slip again.
You're a good man, Jay. Thank you. And we appreciate your time and good reporting as usual. Okay, so when we come back, we keep hearing that the world is about to go through this global recession, if not a depression, and even the U.S. deal with Iran is not going to be able to stop this. Everything's going to blow up economically. I'm going to ask Brandon Weikert about this. He's been a congressional staffer. He's been guiding people in Congress and in the Senate and in Washington. He was recently on with my friend Tucker Carlson, and he's going to help us understand the backstory of what's going on right now with the Strait of Hormuz situation. Brandon's going to join me in just a little bit. We'll be right back. So welcome back, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Recently on the Tucker Carlson podcast, a guy I talk to from time to time, Brandon Weikart, explained how what we're being told about the Iran war may not necessarily be clear or the truth. So what is the truth? What's really going on these days? It does get confusing. Brandon has a master's in international relations, working on a PhD, by the way, I understand. He may have already gotten it, but he didn't call me to tell me. He advises members of the U.S. government, and he's good enough to join us now with a nice, healthy smile. Brandon, how are you, my friend? Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. I should say I did not complete my PhD. I left to go work. So that is the academic field is closed off to me now. But thank you for having me on. We also have a Floridian connection. I think you're a fellow Floridian, as am I.
So, yeah, yeah. I know that. I know that about you. But, you know, I'm from Miami, where all us cube steaks live.
So yeah, I'm on the other coast, so I'm in the slower coast.
they call us the Oyes, you know? Me,
that's
Marco
right,
Rubio, because
right.
We always go around saying, Oye, Oye, right?
so true.
All right, so you and I need to talk, because I am confused. Yeah. And I'm not the dumbest guy in the world. I'm not the smartest guy in the world. But every time I turn around, I'm more confused by what in the world is going on with the Strait of Hormuz. And do we have a deal? Don't we have a deal? Our president, Mr. Trump, said, yes, we're going to be talking to the Iranians, and they're eager to talk to us. Then we heard from the Iranians and said, no, we have no plans to talk to them. So can you just, set the stage for us on where we are right now with this thing?
Yeah, basically, I keep saying it's a non-deal deal for a non-war war. And so it's basically whatever you want it to be, according to the President of the United States. If you want to go to war one day, you can do that. If you want to have a ceasefire, we can do that too.
Oh my God.
The bottom line here is
sounds like a martini. It sounds like a martini bar, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Only less fun. The bottom line here is at the strategic level, which is what I, as a professional geopolitical analyst, look at the strategic level, the realities have not changed in America's favor. Nothing we have done, Rick, has changed the dynamic on the ground. I follow you. I know you did some really good reporting in Tehran recently. Mm-hmm. You probably have a better pulse of that side of the story than I do. But ultimately, it sounds to me and looks to me like, A, the Iranian regime is as strong as it was before the war began, maybe even in some cases stronger if
yes.
you look at how they've, you know. And then also, it looks to me like the strategic level, the Iranians are winning the war. And that has not changed in the last, 100 plus days. The 96 hour war has become 120 plus day war, and nothing we've done has changed that.
So that means the United States being in a deficit situation when it comes to everything you just described. And by the way, you're absolutely right, because for them, this is existential. They will not
That's
quit.
Right.
They will close the Strait of Hormuz if they have to. They will put more weapons in those mountains and shoot down at any of the ships that go in that area, including U.S. forces. I think Mr. Trump knows that. I certainly know Mr. Vance knows that. So they are kind of in the catbird seat right now. The question is, does the United States understand that? And is there enough there for the U.S. to be able to pull this off without getting pulled back in, to use a Godfather reference, by Israel? By Israel, because they're the ones who want to smash this deal, right?
Right. Well, absolutely. And I keep telling everybody that actually, if we were in a car, I would say the Israelis are driving and they're fighting over the steering wheel with the Iranians, who are in the front seat. And we're at best in the back seat, maybe even in the trunk at this point.
Oh, God.
Because we don't have any control over either of these two parties. This is their show. We're stuck in the middle, mixing metaphors now. But ultimately, the Iranians have figured out the center of gravity is the Strait of Hormuz for the United States. And the Iranians have always known their big threat in the region is Israel, but Israel's Achilles heel is U.S. And so if the Iranians can push the U.S. out of the region, keep us on the back heels, we can't help Israel, we won't help Israel, and then Iran and Israel can really duke it out, and I think Iran has the upper hand there.
There's something honorable about what Iran's doing. I talk to these guys a lot, and I've been lucky enough to be allowed into kind of journalistic circles with them, where I get to ask them, like, tough questions. Like, I recently recently was talking to him, and I said, why are you guys doing this? You've got a great deal. I mean, you've got a fantastic... This is one of the best deals I've ever seen. It's almost one-sided toward you. Why don't you walk away from the Lebanon issue? Walk away from the Palestinian issue. I mean, take care of your own people. And, you know, it's nice that you're helping Lebanon. It's nice that you're helping the situation in Gaza. But why are you making that so important that you're allowing it to be a deal killer? And you know what they said to me? It's because that's who we are. It's who we are. Yeah. We can't not do that. That's who we've been for 6,000 years. It's our back. I mean, you know, some people call BS on that. I don't know. I kind of take them at their word that that's.
Well, there's definitely they want to protect fellow Shiites, and Hezbollah, whatever you think of Hezbollah, they are a Shiite militia. That's what they are. That's their unifying principle. I do think, though, there is some cynicism there, if I may.
Of course.
The Iranians benefit from if you're trying to wage war on Israel, and they are for a variety of reasons, and Israel's waging war on them. Mm. But if you're trying to hit Israel from that far away, you need allies on the ground. And Hezbollah is a great force multiplier for Iran when hitting Israel. Furthermore, the Israelis have played right into Iran's hands. The Iranians are happy to see Israel go into southern Lebanon and behave the way they are. Not only does it supercharge Hezbollah, but it also keeps all of the morality and the focus rather on Israel and how Israel's violating norms rather than anybody talking about anything Iran might be doing. And so all of this works in Iran's favor. The Iranians, the key thing here, you mentioned honorable. I will just say, the Iranians have played this thing very judiciously. Mm. They are clearly, in a conventional sense, they are not the equals of the United States militarily, but they don't have to be, and they know it. All they have to do is be able to match us when we go up the escalation chain or ladder. They go right with us, and they've done it very responsibly. So I was somebody like Tucker many years ago. I was a neoconservative, and I just assumed the regime was this crazy. They can't get nukes. They've proven in this war they're actually the rational actor. They have not gone out and started terrorism attacks everywhere. They've not started popping off whatever nuclear materials they may have. They've been very, very limited in their attacks. Mm. Now, it hurts the Arab states and it hurts Israel, but it's always been tit for tat. It has never been this sort of crazy, let the war dogs run wild. It's always been very measured.
But I think the Persian Gulf countries, I think Iran may have earned the respect of a lot of these Persian Gulf countries. At least that's kind of my sense. And I saw it recently when they were having meetings. I mean, who's bringing them in and kissing their behind, so to speak, to get a deal done? It's Qataris.
Right.
It's Oman. It's the Saudis. The Saudis were at the table in Pakistan when they were trying to do this deal.
The Saudis are saying they're willing to help pay that $300 billion fee if the Americans won't, which is shocking. And I'm hearing that the Saudis and the Qataris are done with having U.S. bases long term in their countries because of how unprotected those bases have made those Arab states. What's the one thing the Iranians did very well is not only the Strait of Hormuz has a pressure point against the U.S., but also the Arab states. They figured the three groups they were arrayed against at the start of the war, the U.S., the Gulf Arab states nominally, and Israel, they figured of those three, the Arab states were the most vulnerable and the most vulnerable in terms of economic disruption. Everything those Arab states rely upon is economic, global trade. And so the Iranians immediately squeezed that, and now the Arab states are in a bind. And interestingly, one of the reasons I think that the Saudis are kind of pivoting now, remember, in 2015, a decade ago, Mohammed bin Salman was calling the Iranians the new Hitler of the Middle East.
Yeah.
Now he's being buddies. I think part of that is because Saudi Arabia is actually benefiting from the war. They've actually become sort of this epicenter of repositioning energy flows, and a lot of the money flows out of Dubai are now going to Riyadh. So in a way, they're becoming one of the new major centers of power in this post-American Middle East.
And they set that up. This is an aside. You don't have to answer this. But when I was talking to Arachi when I was in Tehran, you mentioned you saw some of my reporting. You saw in my interview with Arachi, I asked him about the Saudis. I said, well, what's your relationship with them? Do you talk? He goes, yeah, We talk all the time. I talk to the foreign minister, the Saudi foreign minister. He calls me. And this was before the war started. So there was a foundation here for these kinds of relations. Yes. These Gulf states, these Persian Gulf states, are not stupid.
And remember China's role in all of this. Beginning in 2023, China initially brokered a sort of rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Remember, the Saudis were not talking to the Iranians before 2023. From 2015, ever since the Yemen intervention, to about 2023, the Saudis were in, they didn't talk, at the official level at least. And then the Chinese came in and Wang Yi did this sort of negotiated settlement where Saudi Arabia and Iran reopened embassies. So and the Pakistani play here, everybody keeps talking about Pakistan as a mediator in the ongoing Iran war. Remember, Pakistan, yes, they have close ties to the U.S. administration, Rick, but who's behind Pakistan really is the Chinese. I think the Chinese are very brilliantly and deftly, indirectly pushing the Americans out of the Middle East using diplomacy and economics so that they can sort of increase their role there because let's face it, the Chinese view themselves as a more stable actor for global trade.
And whatever the Chinese are doing, it's something they came up with 20 years ago, by the way, while we're trying to
figure out,
you and I are figuring out stuff the night before. two things we ought to talk about before we end this. Yeah. Let's talk about Israel, and then we'll talk about long-range global effects of this thing, which I'm hearing a lot of people talk doomsday and stuff like that. But before we get there... What's the situation in Israel? I hear all kinds of stuff, and I'm not sure. And I think the journalism on this is hard. It's hard to report from there. I'm hearing Bibi's out. I'm hearing the effect on the IDF is really serious. I'm hearing IDF people, soldiers are deserting, that they're running out of troops, that Hezbollah's kind of, you know, had its way in this skirmish. Yeah. In southern Lebanon. And I'm also hearing that most of the drones and the missile attacks from Iran were able to hit, and that the people of Israel are very spooked by all of this. All of that on the table. What's really happening?
Well, a lot of that is true. Israel was hit a lot harder than what is being reported in the corporate press. A lot of that is because of the censorship, that the self-imposed censorship. I think people should understand, Israel actually technically is not really a censorship country. Their own media self-censors. That's how pervasive the culture of censorship is. The government doesn't have to tell them not to share something. Many times these Israeli news outlets just won't report things. That's how it is over there. Yeah. So it's hard to get. And then, of course, the Israelis do restrict certain access, but from what I can tell, there is a major brain and capital flight occurring right now from Israel to the rest of the world. Basically, the kinds of people who would be needed to rebuild an advanced society in Israel, they're taking their family, they're taking their money, and they're going elsewhere because they don't have any faith in the future in Israel. Israel is in a declining state right now. And if this post-American Middle East, in my opinion, that is set to come out, where Iran and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Egypt and Turkey are the new powers in the region, and the Americans don't really have much role there anymore, Israel becomes the contained state. Israel becomes how we used to treat Iran. They're going to treat Israel. And I don't think the future is bright necessarily for Israel, especially if they keep on the pathway that they're on, which is not good for the region or themselves. So that's and Netanyahu is, I think, on his way out politically.
And they are losing America. I mean, whether it's the 60-70% number, some people say, or maybe even just a 40-50% number, or only people under 35 and under 40, whatever the number, whatever the calculation you come up with, and I've seen and read all of them, there is no question that there is an awakening or a movement in America that is kind of like, we've had enough. We've done so much for you guys, and you still don't appreciate it.
It's also a generational shift, Rick. There's a real generational shift in both parties here in the United States, as you know.
Yeah.
And the young people in both parties are, to say the least, skeptical of Israel. So
finally, let's get to the question that I kind of teased our audience that I heard you talk about before, because I keep hearing this. I had a guest on the other day who shared this with me. He said, no matter what happens in the Strait of Hormuz and whether there's a deal or not, the lapse or the after effect of what we've gone through is going to have a very serious effect on the global markets economically, and we will suffer some kind of either recession. Some people are even going as far as saying depression. What's your take? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so there will be, let's just say, a recessionary environment, I think, in the coming quarter or so. And that's because it's been blockaded, the Strait of Hormuz, for so long, as well as the Arab, you know, production facilities, not just of oil and natural gas, but of all of those critical industrial inputs. There have been a massive blockade now since February 28th, basically. And yeah, the Iranians have let a handful of ships go through here and there, but those ships are very small in number and not enough to sustain, to fill those gaps that have now formed going forward. So I believe there will be shortages, notably in energy. There will be shortages in key agricultural goods over the next year. Remember, we're still riding on the reserves from last planting season, but by next, you know, by quarter one of next year, those reserves will be gone. We didn't plant enough stuff this planting season because of the lack of fertilizer. So there are, over the next year, there's going to be dislocations. The question is how deep and how long. Now, if the Trump administration can miraculously get everything reopened in the next few days, then yeah, okay, it's not going to be a deep, painful thing. It'll be temporary. I don't think they're going to be able to do that. I don't think the president is committed to peace. I certainly don't think the Iranians and Israelis are on the same page. So with that in mind, the Strait of Hormuz remains closed. And at that point, we have recession. We're going to have higher prices of energy, which will create higher inflation. The Fed will be required to raise interest rates. That will slow the economy. That will create the conditions for stagflation. Now, you're old enough to remember Jimmy Carter in the 70s and stagflation.
Yeah,
and
that,
I think that's the best case scenario at this point. The worst case scenario is the helium shortage really gets bad. The semiconductors can't be built. Those semiconductors power the AI boom in America. The AI bubble bursts. And on top of everything, the stock market crashes. And you're talking 1929. That's the fear that I have right now, is Trump is becoming Herbert Hoover very fast.
I've heard a lot of people draw that same scenario. And it's a frightening scenario, you know?
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, well, obviously, and I think most people would. Boy, you are just a delight to talk to. I really enjoy talking to somebody with as much energy as you have, because, you know, it's almost
I'm hopped up on a lot of coffee. As you know, we've got Cuban coffee down here, and I like Cuban coffee.
I was just going to say, what are you, part Cuban or something? I mean, you got my energy.
No, but I grew up here, man. This is the culture, you know.
They talk about the Turkish coffee. Yeah. You know what we call our coffee in Miami? Cocaine. Because it's that strong. Hey, listen, if people want to watch you, if people want to check in with you, if people want to contact you, where do they go?
Please, everybody go to the Weichert, W-E-I-C-H-E-R-T, brief at Substack. I just started a couple weeks ago, and it's going gangbusters. And so that's where I'm really channeling a lot of my energy these days. You can follow me on Twitter, at WeTheBrandon, and check out my books on Amazon. I've got four of them, with a fifth one coming out on Western Hemispheric Defense. So, you know, that's where you can find me.
You're a smart guy. You really are. By the way, your mom called during the break, and she said she wants you to go back and get that PhD.
Well, I don't know if academia wants me, but
you're a good guy. Thanks so much. I'll tell Tucker we had a conversation.
I'd love to. Yes, absolutely. He's a good man too.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. That's it for this segment. I should remind you of something, and I'm glad I was talking to Brandon about this. You know, you can usually find us on Spotify and on X and on YouTube, but let me tell you something about a lot of those places, right? YouTube canceled me. They got rid of my 120 followers that I'd taken a year to build, because they just decided one day, this isn't your page. You don't own this material. We do. Your content is our content. That made me so angry, you know? So what I realize is most social media platforms, they answer to their advertisers. They answer to their processors, who decide what you can read, what you can hear, and what you can say. I hate that. That's terrible. But it's what they do. YouTube is one of the worst, by the way. So, you know, let me tell you about BitChute, okay? Because now I'm putting all my stuff on BitChute. Because if nothing else, I know it'll always be there. And they are different. And I do believe in them. And that's my page right there on BitChute. Go there. Subscribe. Be a member. You know, to them, it's not about advertisers and algorithms, right? No one is ever removed. No content disappears. BitChute is where I'm going to do my live stream. Coming up here in about 30 minutes. That's 1 p.m. Miami time, as we like to say, or Cuban coffee time. And then, you know, and during these live streams, you know, I interview Scott Ritter and Mirandy and the Johnsons and the Tuckers of the world. And so look for it. Go to BitChute if you get a chance. Check them out, and you and I will have a conversation there. And I'll see you after the show. Okay, that's it for now. I want to thank you, most of all, just for being here for us. We've been collecting so many comments and so many views and so many viewers and so many people like yourselves. So once again, just thank you so much. It really means a lot to us that you allow us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll see you next time.